In the last part of chapter 14, where we kind of finished or we were working on Wednesday night, beginning at verse 25, Jesus said, "These things I have spoken to you while being present with you, but the Helper, the Holy Spirit, whom the Father will send in my name, he will teach you all things and bring to your remembrance all things that I said to you. Peace I leave with you, my peace I give to you, not as the world gives do I give you. Let not your heart be troubled, neither let it be afraid. You have heard how I said to you, I am going away and coming back to you. If you loved me, you would rejoice because I said, I am going to the Father, for the Father is greater than I. And now I have told you before, and it comes to pass, that when it comes to pass, you may believe. I will no longer talk much with you, but the ruler of this world is coming, and he has nothing in me. But that the world may know that I love the Father, and as the Father gave me commandment, so I do. Arise and let us go from here." In the last part of this text right here, Jesus has some things to say again about peace. Peace is something that, as we said, many people are looking for, but it's something that Jesus has to offer. And so we talked a little bit about comparing what Jesus is offering to that which the world offers. And anything that the world offers is in the way of peace is going to be something that's very shallow. It's not going to be much, because the world can't offer peace, not really, not compared to what Jesus can give, which is real peace and eternal peace. Jesus offers the peace that brings security and protection in the eternal realm. And man cannot take that away. I want us to think about that again for just a minute. A couple of passages that we're going to turn to. A lot of times as we've been going through our John study, I've tried very much just to stay just in the text of John. But today I've got a number of other passages that I want us to kind of pull in our study in this and as we get into chapter 15. Because I think there's something significant here about the idea of the peace that Jesus says, "Peace I leave you, my peace I give to you." And I think that we need to know something about that peace. Because even today, I think sometimes Christians struggle to find and to understand real peace. Philippians chapter 4. Look with me to Philippians chapter 4. The Apostle Paul, on at least a couple of occasions that we look at this morning, had something to say about peace. He knew something about peace. And in Philippians, did I say Ephesians? Philippians chapter 4 is what I mean. Okay, good. Philippians chapter 4. He says something here about the peace that we should know as Christians. Chapter 4 and verse 6 beginning. He says, "Be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God, and the peace of God which surpasses all understanding will guard your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus." Peace again. That there is a peace that Christians can know and understand that it goes beyond what the world can know and understand. It's a peace that should reign very deep within us and in our hearts. It's the peace of God. And it's that which will guard our hearts and our minds. And when you think about the life of Paul, in the time and years that he spent as a Christian, you would think to some degree that he knew very little peace. I mean, his life, it seems, was full of turmoil. And yet, never did he seem to be rattled by that. He always found, you know, comfort in the peace that was found in what comes from God, that which is eternal. And he's trying to help us to see and to understand and to know that same kind of peace. Well, near the end of the apostle's life in 2 Timothy chapter 4. 2 Timothy chapter 4. I mean, we find in the Philippian letter this concern for us to know and to understand peace. But Paul already knew and understood that peace. 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 6. "For I am already being poured out as a drink offering, and the time of my departure is at hand. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. Finally, there is laid up for me a crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give me on that day, and not to me only, but also to all who have loved his appearing. Peace. Even though he knew that the end of his physical life was near, he was looking ahead to the peace that comes in an everlasting realm. And so when we think back to Jesus, and as he is speaking to his apostles, and he is saying to them, "Peace I leave with you, my peace I give to you," and yet the life that they are going to experience from that point until the end of their life, to many degrees, was often not filled with peace as we think of it. I mean, all of them except John would die very difficult and uncomfortable deaths. They would be persecuted. They would be, some of them, they would be imprisoned. They would be beaten. And yet Jesus is saying, "I'm giving you peace." Isn't that interesting? Now, what thoughts or comments do you have to add to this? What would you say? He is soon to say, it's almost in the same setting, because it happens within the next few hours. He says the peace that he brings is the fact that he is going to overcome the world. He will overcome the world. And we can do that too through him. Here is the foundation of our peace.
It's kind of like, there's a lot of parallels between parents or your father, but in particular, when you're little children and God. Like when you're a child and you're growing up in your family, a small child especially, you're not worried about making the mortgage payment on the house. You're not worried about keeping food in the refrigerator or the oil in the tank. You know, if you're on a trip and the car has a flat tire, you know Dad's gonna change it. You're not worried about it. You're a child. And that's kind of the way it is with God and the apostles at this point. In other words, there may be things that are uncertain, there may be difficulties, but you know that Dad is going to take care of it in a way, and ultimately that you're going to be okay, you're going to be provided for, and everything's going to be all right.
Right. Peace. There is something that is amazing and comforting when you're with, I've re-experienced this with the grandkids. You know, just the happy nature that is so often so prevalent that sometimes we can forget about. I mean, because their cares and concerns are not much. They're just having fun. And I don't know. There's I find some comfort in that in some ways, just seeing that and re-experiencing. Yeah, if we never find peace with mankind, which is hard to do, if we are in a position where we have found peace through God and in a relationship with him, then now we can come to understand real peace that has lasting and long-term, you know, opportunities, real peace. And so it's just interesting to me that here, Jesus, knowing what's about to happen in the next few hours and what his disciples are going to see and what they're going to experience now, and for the rest of their lives, is saying, I'm bringing you peace. I'm leaving you peace. That's what I have brought. And yet we have to understand that in the physical realm, they were going to have to deal with a lot of difficulties and turmoil. And yet, even in the face of all of those things, they could still know and understand peace, knowing that this life was going to come to an end at some point, but that was okay. because they would go on to be with the Lord. Other thoughts or comments on that? You know, he said, oh, wait.
Well, it's, you know, things change in the world, but if your peace is founded on God, that's a constant. It's not changing.
That's true. That's true. And isn't that something that's comforting? Because it seems like in the world, everything's changing all the time, you know. But there is a constant consistency with God, and that's comforting. Isn't our hand over here? Kim?
As Jesus does so many times, he tells him something, and then, as you said, just the next short while, he's about to demonstrate what that peace will enable you to do.
You know, that's true. Even when you think about Jesus in the garden and as he's praying, if this cup may pass. I mean, did he want to experience the crucifixion and the cross? I say not. Was he willing to do that? Yes. Because he could find peace even in that, knowing the resurrection, knowing that God was still with him. You know, Jesus talks about this peace. I've come and I leave you peace. And yet in the same passage he says, I will no longer talk much with you, for the ruler of this world is coming, and he has nothing in me. How could one have peace when the ruler of this world has such influence? It's some of the same answers of what we were just saying. But it does bring another perspective, or enlightens the perspective of this. You know, that even in face of the ruler of this age, ruler of the world, you know, having such influence, there is still peace that can be found. You know, in Ephesians chapter 2, there's a passage that uses a similar thought here. Ephesians chapter 2, Paul writing to those who are Christians, reminds them where they came from. Verse 1, he says, "In you he has made alive who were dead in trespasses and sins, in which you once walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit who now works in the sons of disobedience, among whom also we all once conducted ourselves in the lust of our flesh, fulfilling the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature children of wrath just as the others. But God, who is rich in mercy because of his great love with which he loved us, even when we were dead in trespasses, has made us alive together with Christ. By grace you have been saved." I'm thinking peace again. That even though the ruler of this age, even the ruler of the world, you know, can bring much havoc among us, we still find peace because of the experience that's found in the grace and the mercy of God, the hope that is found when you are in Christ Jesus. We find peace. Bottom of page 44, one of our last questions on this page here. Deity or divine being is claimed by Jesus in that text that we just read last. And yet Jesus said, "My Father is greater than I." Now that passage might cause some to say that Jesus is not really deity. See? It says the Father is greater than I. Well, what do you say to that? How do you respond to it? Is that what Jesus is saying? Is now he saying that he's not deity? What would you say to that?
Philippians 2 is what I would say about it.
Philippians 2. You know, look over here for just a second. Think of Philippians 2. I mean, as we're turning there, just think for a moment of all of the times in the text, in the book of John, where Jesus has identified himself with God as the Son of God, as the one sent by God, as being one with God, he said. And so we have all of those, the words of Jesus on those things. And yet there's other passages too. I mean, like Philippians 2, you know, beginning at, let's see, verse 5. "Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who, being in the form of God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, but emptied himself by taking the form of the servant and coming in the likeness of men." It tells us where Jesus was, his place and his position, and what he became. He became a servant to men. But it also tells us that he was with God and did not consider equality with God something to be grasped. He didn't have to grasp it. He was there. It's who he was. And so that's another passage that stands out to me that helps us to see and identify that indeed Jesus is deity, as we might say, that he is God. You know, Jesus and the Father are the same divine makeup. We can see that in the text a number of times. But that doesn't mean that they were exactly the same person. In fact, Jesus would say they're not the same person. You have the Father and the Son, and we noticed in our last study the identification of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. John is one of the writers that I think helps us to best see into and to identify that. But just because they are both of divine nature and of the same divine makeup does not mean that they are the same or of the same authority. Jesus has appealed to the Father's authority how many times? You know, already, you know, in our reading through the book of John, that God has authority, but he has given authority to Jesus to do and to say the things that he is doing. Someone made this analogy, and it kind of stuck with me, that, you know, the president of the United States has greater authority, but he's still a man in nature. God, Jesus is God. He is the Son of God, and yet the Father has more authority. That does not take away the nature of Jesus from being God. He's still God. It doesn't take that away at all. And so Jesus time and again shows his place and his respect to the Father. And yet the Apostle John helps to identify time and again that Jesus is God. Look through the book of John for a second. Go back to chapter 1. Chapter 1. Just think of some of the times the Apostle here has helped us to identify who Jesus is. John chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. And the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God, and all things were made by him, and without him nothing was made that was made. Chapter 5. Chapter 5, verse 17. Chapter 5, verse 17. But Jesus answered them, "My Father has been working until now, and I have been working. Therefore the Jews sought all the more to kill him, because he not only broke the Sabbath, but also said that God was his Father, making himself equal with God." Chapter 8. Chapter 8, verse 58. This powerful statement by Jesus, remember? "Most assuredly I say to you, before Abraham was, I am." Reminiscent of that the similar phrase that God made to Moses, you know, long ago. And you can't help but make the connection of what God said to Moses. Moses said, "Who should I say sent me?" The "I am" sent you. And here Jesus is using that same terminology in reference to himself. Chapter 10, verse 30. Jesus said so simply, "I and my Father are one." Verse 37, Jesus said, "If I do not do the works of my Father, do not believe me. But if I do, though you do not believe me, believe the works, that you may know and believe that the Father is in me and I in him." Chapter 17. Chapter 17, verse 5. We haven't got to this quite yet in our study, but Jesus said as he prayed, "And now, O Father, glorify me together with yourself, with the glory which I had with you before the world was." That text takes us back to Philippians chapter 2 again, doesn't it? Reminding us of just who Jesus was. There's some other passages we could find too. But I got thinking about that and just thought, there's just a few passages here that just stand out in John that identifies the place and the position of Jesus, and helps us to have that in our minds. Your thoughts, comments. Let's look on as the story continues on here can we just transition right into chapter 15? You know, it's the same setting. It's the same people involved here. Whereas we get into chapter 15, Jesus brings us, or John, I should say, writes to us about the last of the seven I am statements of Jesus. Now see, we've already gone through six of them up to this point. This is going to be the last one that comes up here in this chapter. And it's noticeable, we should say, that each of the I am statements have, you know, draws a sharp point of the necessity of having a relationship with Christ. And we've tried to make some note of that in each of the ones that we have seen. And here again, we kind of back up a little bit in our text, looking at these I am statements. Go back to chapter 6, John chapter 6. Remember when Jesus said, I am the bread of life. Do you recall what was it that brought Jesus to that point of saying, I am the bread of life? Do you remember what happened right before that?
They
wanted to be fed. Why did they want to be fed?
They'd just gotten fed.
They'd just gotten fed the day before. 5,000 were fed. There was this great miracle that had taken place. And there were some that came the next day, not so much to hear what Jesus had to say, but to be fed. So, the purpose for the sermon, or you know, that Jesus then had as he was with his disciples, you know, in chapter 6. And, you know, it's there in verse 48 when he says, I am the bread of life. And he was not talking about the providing of physical sustenance. Did he have the ability to do that? Well, indeed, he'd proven that. But the point of what he was saying was, I am the bread of life. That true life was found in him. Spiritual sustenance was found in him. That was the purpose of the statement, I am the bread of life. Well, in chapter 8, Jesus says, I am the light of the world. But remember, there was some reason that he said, I am the light of the world. I mean, how would you deal with that? I mean, if you just turn it around as a question, why did Jesus say, I am the light of the world? What would you say to that? How would you answer that? Why did he say, I am the light of the world?
Light
leads the way. And there were some who have just confronted Jesus. They had brought the woman that, you know, was caught in adultery. And the ones that had brought her had seemingly the mind that they were much better than this woman caught in adultery. But when Jesus put them on the spot, they had to determine even of themselves that no, their lives was, they were not in a position to be able to cast any stone. They could not make judgment against anybody. And Jesus was making the point that he was the light of the world. Some of these religious leaders were not the ones who could give direction. He was the light of the world.
So I was going to say, following the Pharisees was keeping them in the dark.
It was keeping them in the dark. And that's right. I like the way you said that. And Jesus was the contrast, that he was the light of the world. Well, in chapter 10, Jesus said, I am the door. The door. I mean, what is that making a reference to? What led to that point? What was the circumstances where Jesus would say, I am the door? What was that about? Frank, do you remember what was that about?
That's the only way.
That's the only way. That there was only one way to enter.
Well, I was going to say, I think ultimately he was saying he was the door of the sheepfold, mm-hmm. for the illustration.
Right.
And the Pharisees made lousy shepherds, is basically. He was the shepherd who was actually taking care of the sheep and watching after them and keeping them safe. They were not doing that.
They were not.
The hirelings.
That's right. That's right. And he was the one who was the protector, letting the sheep in and keeping the evil or the wicked out. And that he was the only way that you could get to safety. That he was the door.
You have something else?
Okay, good. Well, it's in that same text, chapter 10, verse 11, he went on to say, I am the good shepherd. It's part of the same story, you know, that he is the good shepherd as compared to those who were false or the hirelings. You know, that he was the one who loves us and cares for us and will shepherd and nurture. Chapter 11, he said, I am the resurrection and the life. Do you remember what happened right before he said that? What was the event that took place right before Jesus said, I am the resurrection and the life?
Raising Lazarus.
You know, I mean, this was the event, this is one of the final events that took place that got just so much notoriety. Remember, we were just down to the last few weeks here of the life of Christ at that point, and boy, the raising of Lazarus was kind of the last straw to some of the Jewish leaders, because now so many were wanting to listen to Jesus and be disciples of his. And Jesus said, I am the resurrection and the life. Well, it wasn't about raising Lazarus from the dead, but it's the raising, it's the life, it's the resurrection, the life that we have through him that is eternal. And so all of these I am statements, you see, that they're powerful and almost build one on another. Chapter 14, we just talked about I am the way, the truth, and the life, where Jesus is talking to his closest disciples that this is it. That I am the only way. There is no other way to the Father except through me. And that Jesus is saying, I've been with you. I've helped guide you. And even though he's saying that I'm leaving, I'm going to send a helper who will continue to teach and to lead and to guide you, because he was the way. And now in chapter 15, the last I am statement. Jesus says, I am the true vine. And so our purpose now in this lesson is to think about, well, what does he mean by that? I'm the true vine. I mean, life, you know, we can understand the point and the analogy of produce that's growing, you know, on a vine. There has to be a vine that is alive and well and healthy. And Jesus saying, I am the true vine. Let's look at the text. This lesson, lesson 23, covers only 8 verses. I want us to spend a little bit of time looking at verses 1 through 8, because there's so many powerful points and stories that come out of this text. Chapter 15, verse 1. I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine dresser. Every branch in me that does not bear fruit, he takes away. And every branch that bears fruit, he prunes, that it may bear more fruit. You are already clean because of the word which I have spoken to you. Abide in me, and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit of itself unless it abides in the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me. I am the vine, you are the branches. He who abides in me and I in him bears much fruit, for without me you can do nothing. If anyone does not abide in me, he is cast out as a branch and is withered, and they gather them and throw them into the fire, and they are burned. If you abide in me and my words abide in you, you shall ask what you desire, and it shall be done for you. By this my Father is glorified, that you may bear fruit, so you will be my disciples. Well, let's just think for a few minutes here about the analogy, the metaphor that Jesus uses here. In fact, our question is, first question, explain the allegory that Jesus made, saying that he is the true vine and the Father is the vine dresser. So what does that mean? What is Jesus saying? Parable. There's an earthly story here, but there's a spiritual meaning to what Jesus is saying. And it's the kind of an example that we can all understand. You don't even have to be a farmer to understand this. You know, if you've ever stuck a seed in the ground and tried to grow a pumpkin, you can understand something about this right here.
The branch only gets life by abiding in the vine.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, we cut off a branch of any growing vegetable or anything
sure.
like that, it's going to die.
It's going to die.
The life only comes from abiding in the vine. And Jesus is saying, I am the vine.
I am the vine. Yeah. Yeah. When you're separated from the vine, there could be no life. Okay? Good. What else? Anything else? Go ahead.
The canes, what they're typically called in the jargon of vineyard growers are canes, or the branches, basically. And the ones that are not producing fruit are a hindrance or a drain to the nurture
mm-hmm.
of the ones that are producing fruit.
Right.
And typically, the canes grow every year, new canes grow every year, and those are the ones where the fruit is produced on the vines. So that they're what you want to do if you're pruning a grapevine is cut all the old canes that
mm-hmm.
are no longer producing any fruit, and that gives the energy, the source, the nutrients to the ones that are
to grow fruit.
Producing fruit.
Yeah. And so there has to be some spiritual application, you know, to this. I've never grown grapevines, but I can see and understand how that works. And, you know, a lot of fruit would kind of work the same way. Planted some fruit trees when we were on the farm. I don't know why I went through so much work doing that, knowing that we were going to move from there at some point. But I planted a number of apple and peach trees, and, of course, I didn't know anything about how to do it. And so tried to do some reading and study about that. And, you know, pruning means everything in the world about what kind of yield you are going to get. And so in the fall, I would go through our early spring, I would go through my process of pruning just like they had told me what to do. And it almost seemed to me like there wasn't much of my trees are small, you know, wasn't much left. You know, it was just amazing. The first couple of years that I did that, you know, it seemed like I'd cut away a lot of what had grown the last year. And I thought, man, this can't be right. And yet, when it started coming on in the spring, it was amazing to me how fast, you know, new branches came out and how strong and prolific they were. And somehow that made an impression in my mind, gave me a little better understanding, because I've never had grapevines. You know, and that's the only thing I can relate it to is these trees, a little better understanding of what Jesus was saying here. Because if you've got a branch on a fruit tree that's not producing anything, it's not doing you any good. And in fact, it's taking away from other good that can happen because it's taking those nutrients away. And somehow I just understand that a little bit better now. And the deer certainly seemed to appreciate how the trees were starting to put on fruit and everything. I never touched a fruit, but the deer sure enjoyed it all.
I can tell you something about grapevines. When you prune those, you might have a long piece from the branch.
From the vine.
From the vine. You want to tell you about the grapes closest to the vine.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, a beautiful point. The grapes closest to the vine are going to be the ones that have the greatest nutrient, you know, from the source where the food, the strength comes from. That's right. Yeah, that's a good point. You know, when you think about what Jesus said here in the analogy as it's written for us, it tells us something about the absolute necessity of a relationship with Christ in order to have a spiritual life. There is no hope of a spiritual life when we are separated from Christ, when we are separated from the vine. It can't happen. And even if we are still connected some way, but we are not producing, we are not growing, we are like a branch that is just withered up, that connection is going to be disconnected at some point. The vine dresser is going to do that. Who's going to do that? God's going to do that. Because remember here, the analogy is Jesus is giving this to us. Jesus is the true vine. The Father is the vine dresser. He is going to prune off that which is not productive. What are your thoughts here?
I've always been puzzled by verse 3, where he seems to shift gears. All of a sudden says, you are already clean because of the words I've spoken to you. I don't know what all the Greek means there, but I wonder if that is some sort of relation to pruning, that they've already been pruned. And the way it has occurred is the thing that I think is important because of the word he has spoken to them. But somebody else might be able to comment on that, but why does he use the word clean there?
My take on it is just as you have said. You know, you think about the fact, I mean, Judas is no more. He's not with them anymore. And so now he's down to the 11 that were, you know, that were connected to the vine, so to speak. And in so many ways, it would seem as though they've been pruned. I mean, they have seen, they have experienced so much with Jesus already, you know, that they've had to deal with. And so, I mean, maybe it's a little bit simplistic, but that's basically the thoughts I had on that too.
My notes in the study part here says prunes means cleanses.
Oh, okay.
Cleanses it. It says once the fruit's on the vine dress cleanses the fruit of bugs and diseases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, maybe that is somewhat more of a reference to Judas even. You know, that the vine has been cleansed and that there's been this separation of that which was evil. Yeah.
Well, it's through the word which I have spoken to you, mm-hmm. That's how he is. Yes. That process has taken place. Mm-hmm. So he has, you know, everything he has taught them, yeah. Has brought them.
They have listened
to the vine. They have been cleansed and pruned and purified through that.
Yeah.
And the word becomes crucial in this analogy a little later on as well.
That they have been... They've received those nutrients that come from the vine, that come through the Word. And he's going to have some more to say about the Word here as we go on with that. Okay, good. And so I just want to make sure that we have this, because part of this here was to understand the example, the analogy. The vine dresser, or the husbandman, some text may say, is the caretaker of the vineyard. And that's God, that's the Father. And the branches, you know, individual disciples who are expected to bear fruit. So we understand who he's speaking of here. And the true vine is Jesus. He is the one who is the true vine. And so since Jesus is the true vine, our question is, what does he provide? We've dealt with this. What does Jesus provide as the true vine? What do you say? He offers the truth. It is his word. He provides the nutrients. He provides the cleansing. He provides life. And to be separated from the true vine is to not have life. And that becomes part of the power of this text. To be separated from the true vine is to be separated from life. To be separated from the true vine is to be separated from God. There is no relationship with God if we are not connected to the true vine, if we are not connected to Christ. And that's kind of the thrust of the power of what the text is saying as we look on. We've got more to say on our time is gone. Denny, real quick, yeah. But they're not the real thing. Yeah. Okay. Good. That's a good point.
When you plant a grapevine, you have to take a twig off of the main source, put it in water until it roots, and then
right.
You plant it.
Yeah.
And then you've got to start the vine.
Got the true vine. Okay. Good. Good thoughts. Lord willing, Wednesday night, we take up here on page 45 down toward the bottom.